Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
How's it going?
It's going okay. It's Friday, which is always a positive in my book.
I agree. I'm a big fan of Friday.
Even if it's Friday the 13th.
Ooh, whatever. Ooh, spooky.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Super spooky. Numerology.
That's right. That's right. Superstition.
Yep.
And not the Stevie Wonder song.
No. That's much better.
It is. It's way better.
Than actual superstition. The, I did a silly thing, which was, okay, let me back up. So we were trying to figure out what, I did the story about 32-bit apps generating warnings on the latest version of macOS. And that's all they do. And Apple has said, and said last year at WWDC that after High Sierra, you know, they would run 32-bit apps would run, I don't know what they said, not degraded, but something like that, like with less of something or other. But it would run, which is a definite implication. And I checked, like, the next macOS is still going to run these things. They may, like, by default not run or something, but they will be runnable. You may have to, like, turn something on and it'll say, oh, but things aren't as nice when you turn this on, but, you know, whatever. And then I was trying to confirm this, and I got Russell from Shifty Jelly, who's in Australia, on my Thursday evening, or Wednesday evening, to test it, because it went live on Thursday at local time. And we finally found an app that he could use, he'd download, and that generated the alert, and that was great. But the other thing he noticed is that all of Apple's 32-bit apps don't generate the alert, which is
right.
Pretty funny, right? Like, don't contact us. We know and don't care. Contact all the other developers that are out there. And that led me to the conversation with somebody about QuickTime Player 7, which has stuck around all of this time because it does all these things that QuickTime Player 10 does not. Because my understanding now is that QuickTime Player 10, like, doesn't even use, like, the QuickTime APIs for almost anything. It is, and they haven't updated those APIs for 64-bit, and that's why it's so poor. An app for, not for playing videos as much as for all of these sort of, like, copy and paste and, like, quick kind of video utility. A person we know who works actually as a professional in the entertainment industry texted me today saying, likening it to like Preview, mm-hmm. where like you can do lots of things in Preview. Yes, it is a viewer of files, but there's a lot you can do, and that ideally the video player in macOS would similarly be capable, and QuickTime 7 was capable of that, and QuickTime 10 is not. There are a whole bunch of missing features. Anyway, so I don't know, kind of a joke, because I was thinking about how Apple is making this alert for third-party developers, but not for Apple. And I thought, oh, you know what I should do is file a radar, an Apple bug ticket, saying, you know, QuickTime 7 hasn't yet been updated for 64-bit. Knowing that they're never going to do that, but I thought that would be...
It's a bit of a troll.
Yeah.
Bit of a troll.
Yeah, but I thought that would be kind of a funny little statement about, hey, you know, this thing that people still use and you haven't touched it. So that got closed yesterday. I got the email saying Apple has responded to your bug, and I logged in and it said this is not going to be addressed. It's like, all right, fair. I was just doing it for fun. Took a screenshot of that and tweeted it, which led to a whole bunch of conversations about it. And I did, by the way, last night file a new bug with Apple.
I saw it, yes.
Saying
yes.
That that QuickTime 10 player needs to have features added to it that are missing from the other app that is now going to be deprecated, which I assume will also be closed, although it may be closed as a dupe, because presumably... Yeah. Thousands of tickets have been filed saying, why is QuickTime 10 not as good as QuickTime 7? So this morning I woke up and I'm sitting there thinking, oh, yeah, you know what I should probably do? I probably need to write a story for Six Colors about this if I went to all of this trouble. And then I looked and you already wrote the story. So what I'm saying is, thanks, Dan, for writing that story I didn't have to write.
You,
for taking
you
my stupid, stupid tweet and... Well, I can't... Yeah, I can't get up earlier
you gotta
than you.
Get up
You're
pretty
three
early
hours
in
ahead.
The morning. That's right. That's right. It's a... Sorry. That's just the advantage I've got going for me.
No, I was very happy to see that I didn't have to do it. I was like, Dan, and then I was like, no, that's great. Thanks, Dan.
Well, it was funny because we did have a conversation about this in one of our Slacks about QuickTime 7 and about how annoyed we were because we do still use it for a handful of things. And the truth is, you know, there are other apps that do a lot of what QuickTime does. But, I mean, you kind of got to do it in different places.
It's sort of silly, right? Like, I mean, this is a thing that I think to our friend, our mutual friend's point, Preview is a great example. Like, Preview does all of this stuff. And it's like, yeah, sure, you could do all of those things in a PDF utility or an image editor and all of that. But then, you know, here it is. Look, it's easy to have something simple and light.
You want it baked in, right? Because, like, you don't want there are certain tasks that you don't want people to have to go and, like, find an app to do.
I mean, I've got Final Cut 10. I've got iMovie. I can use those to do those things, but that's overkill, crazy. Too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is there are a couple things. I learned something about QuickTime Player 10 while I was writing that, which was that it does actually know what chapters are in audio files. It's just incredibly opaque about how you actually navigate them. And it's bad. It's bad about it. Basically, there's like a menu command that lets you go forward or back a chapter, but there is no indication in the UI that those exist or that it knows they exist. The old QuickTime Player 7 at least had like a little drop down that showed you all the chapters. And so it's kind of absurd that it's like, yeah, we made a little thing that lets you like go back and forth between chapters. Are we going to tell you that there are chapters? No, we're not going to do that. And, you know, I think we all thought when QuickTime Player 10 came out, there was a lot of griping about it and how underpowered it was. And I think we all just kind of assumed like, oh, they'll get around to adding this stuff at some point. But it's been like 8 years. It's been a really long time.
Yeah. And behind the scenes, it sounds like basically QuickTime is, I mean, it's an old brand. It goes back ages and ages and ages. It goes back like 20 years. But QuickTime was shorthand for a whole bunch of different multimedia APIs that Apple built a while ago. And when QuickTime Player 10 came out, what they were basically doing is saying, you know, we aren't going to rebuild the QuickTime APIs for 64-bit. We're not going to do it. We're going to just write up a much more bare bones media player app, and then we're going to walk away. And that seems to be what happened behind the scenes, is that it's not just that the app isn't as capable. It's that they're not the old API, which probably for lots of reasons, like, is not a priority because the world today is very different than it was then. And QuickTime as a concept may not even be relevant. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable argument to make.
Sure.
But they walked away. And so what we're left with is, you know, again, it's like, okay, that's fine. That's how transitions happen, and it's great that the old thing is still kicking around, but if you've got a bunch of users who use this thing to do a whole bunch of stuff that is the multimedia equivalent of something like Preview, why would you not prioritize somewhere in your macOS development, or even your macOS and iOS cross-platform development, some stuff, an app, something that is just a basic tool that lets you get some of these basic things done of extracting an audio file or exporting to various formats or putting audio on top of video and then being able to export that as a compatible, like, MP4 or whatever. Like, stuff that it's overkill to do anywhere but in QuickTime Player. And Apple seems, for whatever reason, to have just no interest in that concept.
I wonder if it's just so, it feels so niche to them that they just are like not even aware that people, I have no idea how many people actually do use it. I know a lot of people in my acquaintance use it, but I'm not sure if that adds up or goes beyond that.
My tweet last night got passed around enough that I had like 15 replies from people who were like, oh no, like, because they hadn't thought about it. Also, Greg Pak, the comic book writer who also is a filmmaker sometimes, he replied to me and he said, oh, does this mean Final Cut 7 is going to stop working? And I was like, yeah, actually, yes, it does. Yes, that's a 32-bit app. Yes, it does. So there's a lot of ramifications for this, which is maybe 18 months from now, maybe longer, there will be a point where a new OS will come out. And at that point, if you're still using old software, it's fine. You don't need to update. You can stay on the old software and that's fine. The problem is that at that point, all new Macs that ship won't support the old OS. And so if your computer dies, I mean, because that's how software really dies, right? And you're not going to be doing video editing and emulation, that's not going to happen, right? So basically at that point, the problem becomes that new hardware can't run your program anymore because you can't it will only run the latest version of macOS that shipped when it shipped, and then you're out of luck. So if you're on Final Cut 7, you can still use it for 18 months, and in fact, you can use it beyond that because you can buy the last computer Apple ships that is compatible with the last version. But after that, you can't buy more advanced hardware and run it.
Right. I mean, at that point, the answer, I mean, Apple's point of view about that point is like,
give up
to the new Final Cut
give
Pro,
up.
Right? Like,
yeah.
You know, use
it. Well, it's great that you're still using PageMaker on a Power Mac 7100. It's great. It's great.
I think
more power to you, but at some point you got to stop.
Yeah. I think the version of Word I have is 32-bit. Because it's from circa Macworld days.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, the
2007.
I've got a copy of Word 5.1 in a Mac emulator that's like emulating like a Quadra or something like that, and that works fine. You could write whole articles in it because, you know, typing, it's not that hard.
Sure. Yeah.
So
I mean, not that
yeah.
I have any particular love or attachment to Office 2007.
Yeah, but this is and you know, and as I've talked about on this podcast and on other podcasts too, we also have the big like processor thing. Like somebody quite right in my Twitter replies today said, because I mentioned, well, you can emulate macOS, like that's allowed. You can buy a copy of VMware and put El Capitan in it and keep running it. Right? It's going to, for video editing, I wouldn't recommend it, but you could do it. But he said, yes, but how well will the emulation work when they switch to ARM? And I was like, yeah, well, not so good.
Yeah, different architectures is a much bigger problem.
So
as all of us who used to run Windows stuff back on the in the PowerPC days.
people, for all the controversies that we have about things like renting software, right? Like software subscriptions and things, and people don't like it. They're like, no, I like it the old way where you buy a piece of software and you just get to use it forever. But one of my arguments was always like, you don't really get to use it forever because at some point the OS will be updated and it won't work anymore. And the file formats that are required, you know, for, you know, interchange or whatever will make it harder to use it. And they will all go away. And that doesn't mean you can't still use ancient hardware, or ancient hardware to run ancient software. You totally can. And after a long enough period of time, you can emulate it because the new hardware is going to be so powerful that you can emulate it. But that is the truth, that with anything as a computer user, you are vulnerable. You know, if you buy a hammer, the hammer will work until you break it or something. It will work a long time. But you buy computer software, you're reliant on that software and the software of the operating system that it runs on and the hardware that is compatible with those software pieces. And
right,
you know,
sooner or later, even things like network authentication, right? Like
yeah.
I'm thinking of, you know, old game consoles that have network services attached
nothing,
to them that go under.
Nothing is forever.
Nothing lasts forever. Yeah.
Nothing is forever. I did turn on my PS3 and it had a software update for me, and I thought, wow, that is impressive, because what? Who is? But it did, because I got a game that our friend Anthony Johnston worked on, Dead Space, which I've never played, and I realized at one point he kept talking about it, and I was like, I could probably get that pretty cheap. It's like, yep, I can get that for $8 on Amazon, and I have a PS3. In fact, I have two PS3s. Don't ask why.
You got a PS6.
So rub them together. The cell processors just will divide and create a PS6. Speaking of emulation and things like that, something else that I did this week is I set up an emulation box. I got a Raspberry Pi,
mm-hmm.
And a little plastic case for it and a little power plug for it. That was about $50. And after almost no time, like 15 minutes of setup, I have a little longer to get wireless, the PS3 wireless controller paired to it. But Julian's on spring break this week, and I thought, you know, actually this would be a fun project, because then he could just spend the week playing ancient Nintendo games, essentially. And he did. that totally happened. For $50, we made a little emulation station, and I found a friend with like every SNES ROM image ever of every game, and some Game Boy games too. And he and his friends, you know, they love video games, and they are in the Wii and Switch generation. And so there are all of these like, oh, but there's this old Legends of Zelda game, and there was this like the Mario Party 2 was supposed to be the best Mario Party game, but they're all like rumors. Or maybe they see a YouTube video that shows it.
Sure.
And so that was actually kind of fun. So in the end, emulation can solve a lot of this stuff.
I mean, bring it back. I did that a while back on my Mac Mini. I have one of the emulators there that plays old, you know, old video games and arcade games and stuff like that. It works pretty well.
I bought one of those 8-bit SNES Bluetooth controller things, which, and the other thing I told Julian was, yeah, you could also just pair this with that. He's got my old previous MacBook Air. It's like you could pair it with that and run OpenMU on there and do the same thing. But it is kind of fun that there's this little incredibly small plastic box with a computer in it that was $50. Boots Linux, you know, boots the Raspberry Pi Linux right into the emulation station software. And the best part, this is the part that impressed me, because I've done some hacky things like this in the past, but they thought of everything. Like literally once it's on my network, I just mount it as an SMB share and drag the ROMs in. I don't need to pull the card out and put it in an adapter and stick it in my Mac and drag files on. I can do that. But I don't need to do that. It's an SMB share on my local network. So if Julian's like, oh, what about this game? Can you get that game? I'm like, yeah, I can totally get that game. And I just pop it on there, and then it's just on there. It's what a world is what I'm saying. When you get old enough and you see things you just wouldn't believe.
I was gonna say, when it gets to the point when you're emulating 30-year-old hardware, it turns out modern hardware is actually pretty solid at that for the most part.
pretty good. Yeah, it's and that's fun. That's fun because that stuff doesn't die. I mean, you mentioned old games. I mean, the challenge is all the old games that are tied to online services and stuff are gonna die.
My favorite is still the I love, if you remember the copy protection from the late 80s, early 90s, a lot of the times I remember this very well, playing games at people's houses, the copy protection involved looking up like words
in the manual.
And so you got to go find like scans of those manuals.
The other week when I was doing my Apple II spelunking and got all those Apple II discs out, I also found the box with Micro League Baseball in it, which was a great Mac like stats based baseball game, baseball sim. That was the kind of game that I really loved, and I played that a lot. And it's just discs, and I'm pretty sure that, you know, in the era that it came from, it's a disc that's bootable. And I've got a Mac Plus basically sitting here, and one of the things I can turn it on, but I can't boot it because I don't have a hard drive and I don't have any system discs. And I thought, oh my god, I could probably put that in there and actually play this game, which would be cool. I couldn't do anything but that, but I could do that. But the reason I bring this up is that I don't know if I had the manual. I think maybe the manual is with it, which is good, because that was a manual copy protection thing where the first time you launched it, it would say, look at page 3, line 5, and give me the first word.
Right,
and then you
had
to type that in, and then it would work. And the idea there was, it took a lot more work to photocopy a manual. And in those days, you couldn't really scan it in and post the scans, because it would be
huge,
way bigger than the actual thing. And so that was how they did copy protection. It was smart.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, but it's so of the era, right? Like, well, that was just...
And I had a, what was it? I was playing one of the Infocom games that had that. And you have to actually, like, go on the internet and look up what it is, because, you know, nobody has the manual anymore for those games. But you can run them in an emulator, but then you need to put in the copy protection phrase or whatever to go on.
I ran into trouble. I think I read a post about this a year or so ago, trying to install an old version of Escape Velocity, the Ambrosia game, and it was because I couldn't retrieve my serial number. Like, they had a, you know, a web service where it's like, put in your email and we'll email you your serial number, but, you know, it's broken because it was a company that is, I don't know if they're defunct, but they're effectively defunct, it feels like. And then, like, I had to do some, I feel like I eventually managed to get it. I don't remember what rigmarole it involved, but like that is a downside too, these situations where it's like, you know, software that you've legitimately bought, but you can't, necessarily find your serial number or whatever like copy protection you used to have. There's always a weak link in the chain.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's, I mean, all these things for me often just feel like a novelty. Like I go and, you know, mess around because I want to see if I can figure out how to do it. And once I've done it, like I installed the emulator on my Mac Mini. I got a bunch of old Nintendo games. I played very few of those for any length of time. One, because old Nintendo games are by and large very hard.
Yeah.
And emulators actually make them easier because you can do things like save your games that used to be basically impossible. And two, just because like I have so much other like crap vying for my attention, that right. The idea of sitting down and playing like a 30-year-old game for anything longer than about 15 minutes, it just, you know, my brain just is not going to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like I said, I feel like for Julian getting to play these earlier generation Nintendo games that he never got a chance to play, but he's heard about or seen videos of talk about. And in one case, he and a friend of his, there's a game that was never released, but the disc image of it is available. It's a little bit like, because I think that just happened with a different Nintendo game, but it was the same thing. Like they finally released it with one of their little emulator systems because they had it. And, you know, after 20 years, it doesn't really matter. Although the thing that I really was impressed by is I also downloaded a bunch of like a zip file full of Atari 2600 images because that was my childhood console. And they're really hard to play because it's terrible. But it's just terrible.
It was the limitations of the day.
Oh, man.
Those things were awesome at the time.
It was mind-blowing that you could do that in 1981, but it's just terrible now. But the thing about that that's cool, which it reminded me of the Apple II thing that I talked about, where like there's a new version of ProDOS that was released in 2016. And, you know, there's software to transfer from modern computers to the Apple II and back again that somebody wrote in the last 5 years, basically, or 10 years.
Right.
And that means there's new development going on in this old platform. Well, I will say this too. There is an active community of people who for certain definitions of active, but like those Atari 2600 images, like a non-trivial amount of the ones in the list are new, are like from the last 10 years or the last 15 or 20 years. They are not from the 80s. Like there are a bunch of games in there that people have written long after that platform died, which I think is brilliant. Like I think that this was my thought about the Nintendo, like whether they do the virtual consoles or they do those little plastic boxes that they sell and that have been such a big seller. It's like, guys, talk to the emulation community and commission a game. Like how awesome would that be to say you buy this little SNES thing and guess what? It comes with a new SNES game. That would be so cool and mind-blowing, and yet they seem to not be that interested in it. And I wonder if there's some like legal reasons and corporate reasons of like, oh no, well we can't endorse the fact that these people are doing this. But it's like, no, but it would be so cool to release a new SNES game. That would be so wacky. So I don't know. But anyway, he is having fun playing those games. And I think the way the emulation station works is you can favorite a game pretty easily and then go to the favorites menu.
Right.
And what's happened over this week is that like five or six games have been favorited. So like he goes through and it's all, you know, again, it's overwhelming. It's all you can eat. It's like literally every game that ever got made for this console is available to you. Well, what are you going to do? And the answer is in most cases, you're like, nah, this is no good. Next game. Nah, this is no good. Next game. But you find a few, you're like, oh, I really like this. I'll play, you know, Battletoads or whatever a little bit.
Well, every once in a while, too, you should just go in and like yank the plug out of the wall just to give them a taste of what it was like.
Yeah. Go do your homework, young man. I have to admit, one of the reasons I got it is that I wanted to also do some arcade emulation and put Joust on there because that's the game that's the arcade game I am best at. And so that's fun. It's on there now. And I favorited that myself because I'm like, yeah, I'm going to play that. I played a little bit of Frogger, too. I'm too impatient for Frogger. That's the problem with Frogger is Frogger, you actually need to be patient. And I just want to just run that frog all the way across the road there. And sometimes that leads to a dead frog.
My 2600 game was Pole Position.
Oh, yeah.
And to a lesser degree, Karateka.
Oh yeah, well that was the best. I played on the Apple II, and that was yep. I loved that game a lot. I wonder
we didn't have a 2600. My cousin had a 7200.
Right. Yeah, the yeah. next generation that or two next generations. I don't know. But I never had one of those. I went straight from the Atari 2600 to the PlayStation 1. In between, yeah, I had that's only like, computers.
I went from the original Nintendo to an Xbox 360.
Yeah, see, yeah, that's there's a time shift,
slight time shift. I think but that same it, idea,
especially for people from my era and your era, there was that moment where you got into the computer stuff,
yes.
and then the console was kind of irrelevant for a while, and then at a later time the consoles kind of came back because they had cooler stuff that you could like. Yeah, when I got that PlayStation, it was like, oh, this is the, and there was a point when the 50% of American households had a Sony PlayStation. I mean, it was a ridiculous number. It was such a huge hit, and it was the breakthrough. And that's when the modern console era really kind of started, I think, is for that, because that was like breaking through to like people like me, people in their 20s who were like, had not had a video game console, but still played some games on the computer. And then that was that moment of you mean I should probably do this. And I've downloaded a few of those, Crash Bandicoot and yeah.
It was the PlayStation and the Nintendo 64 for me, neither of which I owned, but my friend owned one. And that was like the house we would go to after school, junior high school, and play all the multiplayer games, fighting games, and GoldenEye later on, Mario Kart, all that junk, just for, God, for years. I mean, even when I was in freshman year of college, somebody had an N64. They hooked up into our lounge TV, which was hilarious because the lounge TV we had was missing, like, didn't show all the color, like one of the tubes had gone. So we're like, people would be doing something, you like couldn't see red or something on it, and it was just like, it's just a nightmare.
Yeah.
What? Those were the days, though, weren't they?
Yeah, good times. I had that. Well, I showed Lauren the Crash Bandicoot, which she and I both played a lot, and she said, "Does it look bad? Or was it always this bad?" And I said, yeah. "I hate to break it to you, it was always this bad." She said, no, it looked so good. I'm like, yeah.
I went to download my favorite fighting game of all time from the PlayStation for ROM, which is a game called Bushido Blade. Mm-hmm. And we would play hours of this game, and we loved it because it was a fighting game that was like, quote unquote, realistic. Like you could throw like a knife into the other guy's leg and they would start limping for the rest of the match. And I just remember it being this amazing transformative fighter game, and I went back and the graphics were so bad. It looked like Minecraft.
This is the thing about emulation stuff is there are two things that you have to look at, and one is the graphics and sound and the other is the gameplay. And the fact is, like Nintendo really owned the 8-bit stuff, especially, right? So I feel like those old Nintendo games, although they're hard, right? That's a gameplay issue. The sound and the graphics, like, don't bother me, because that is an aesthetic that Nintendo continues to cultivate today, and it feels like a classic. And so then it's all about gameplay. And it's the same way, like, I was playing NFL Blitz 2000 for Sony PlayStation, which I used to play, God, all the time. The NFL wisely, by the way, dropped that license because it was a game in which you were encouraged to just, like, brutally hit people and knock them unconscious. And, like, after they were down, you could still hit them and stuff like that. It was very wise of the NFL at some point to be like, yeah, this is probably bad. And there's a version of it now on, I think I have for like Xbox, that's called The Blitz, and there's no licensing, but it's still kind of fun. But it's arcade football, and it was a lot of fun. And it you know what? I played it for about 10 minutes, and I thought, I could sit here and play this all day, because it's fun to play.
Right.
But yeah, the graphics are terrible. But if the gameplay's okay, then it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I played there was a game I loved for the original Nintendo called Super Spike V-Ball, which is basically just a beach volleyball game. And for whatever reason, I enjoyed the hell out of that game as a kid, and I sort of fired it up and was playing it. I was like, actually, this is pretty entertaining. Yeah. Like, I don't think I would play this for like hours on end, but I played for like half an hour for an hour or something and was like, this game is it's stupid fun. It is stupid fun. I mean, this is a game where you can hit, like, you know, a volleyball spike that bursts into flames and knocks the other guy off their feet, right? Like, it's a ridiculous game, but it really triggered that nostalgia thing. And as I've said before, I'll say again, it's a hell of a drug.
Yep, it is. It's not what it used to be.
Yeah, never is. But then I go and try to play the Darkwing Duck game, which I could never beat. And I was like, this is just so hard. It's just so hard and brutal. Why?
Anything else before we go? I feel like we've covered a lot of ground in the past.
Not unless you want to talk about Apple and leakers or HomePod sales.
Nah.
Nah.
No, HomePod sales. I mean, you wrote about that, and I thought that was good. And I think that the HomePod, it would not surprise me that HomePod sales are poor. It's a tough market. It's an expensive product, and it's missing features that they have yet to add. But it's Apple. I think they're gonna. You know, I think I have hopes anyway. They will keep pushing the software forward, and they'll push the hardware forward, and maybe they'll cut the price, or they'll release a more affordable model. I'm hoping that at one of these iOS betas is going to drop with beta firmware that you can put on your HomePod to try out the stereo stuff, because I would really like to do that. I actually have just appeared behind the curtains. I've got my review unit of the HomePod, and I also bought a HomePod. The one I bought is literally still in the box it was shipped to me in.
I was about to say, you're the guy with two HomePods. Huh?
I am the guy with two HomePods, and I keep thinking, like, when I got it, I was like, oh, man, I should just send this back. But it's like, no, I want to have two HomePods because the day is going to come when they're going to do stereo pairing, and I want to write about the stereo pairing of the HomePod. And so I need to have two HomePods for that, but one of them stays in the box. So I hope that day comes, because I would like to write about that. And I bet it actually sounds pretty good. I've been thinking of putting them on both sides of my living room and letting them, you know, work together. And it might actually be pretty great, but I don't know when that's going to happen.
Three.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's tough. I still only really use mine when I like remind myself that it's there. I've been air playing more music to it, which is fine, but also feels kind of, you know, old school in the sense that it's like it's just an AirPlay speaker for me right now, like more than anything. And it sounds good. Sounds fine. I'm not sure to my ears it sounds much better than a Sonos, and that may just be my ears.
No, I think it sounds pretty. I mean, I think it sounds better maybe than the Sonos Play One, but not a lot.
For me, I'm not an audiophile. I've never been an audiophile, and I can't really tell. Like, I mean, I can tell it sounds better than the Echo. But that said, like, I'm still going to use the Echo in the kitchen when we listen to the radio or podcasts or anything, and none of that is a problem, right? Like, it's good enough. It's more than good enough for all of those things. So the incremental, advantage of having a speaker with really great sound is, to me, it's even a smaller percentage of the time, because listening to, you know, just like really listening to music on it is a smaller chunk of what I do with it.
Yep. Yep. All right. Well, thanks to everybody out there for listening and for supporting Six Colors. We appreciate it. And until next time, Dan, goodbye.
Goodbye.